Welcome to Raising Heretics, Teaching Kids to Change the World, the podcast. I'm Dr. Linda McIver, the author of the book, and also the founder and executive director of the Australian Data Science Education Institute, a charity dedicated to building the data science, data literacy, and STEM skills of students around the world using authentic projects. This book is a blueprint for an evidence-based future, and this podcast is essentially an audio version of the book. I hope that you engage with the ideas in the book, challenge them, question them, share them, and let's make some noise and radically change the education system to build a better future. Chapter 6, Projects with Impact. In the beginning, there were toys. When I first started secondary teaching at a new science school, I was teaching two subjects, a Year 10 Introduction to Computer Science subject called Creative Studies that had been created by a computer science academic, and a Year 11 Computer Science subject that I had the freedom to create the way we wanted it with my co-teacher, Victor Rajewski. Creative Studies in its first year, before I started, included robotics, simulation, natural computation, and Python programming. The students used a system called StarLogo, a block-based programming language similar to Scratch, which is what's known as an agent-based simulation system. This means that the code students wrote was to control agents or sprites on the screen that could then interact with each other and with their environment. The simulation project in that first year before I started teaching at the school was bushfires. The students could take it as far as they wanted, creating houses, trees, different terrain, firefighters, homeowners, etc. So it was a real system they were simulating, but the scenarios were fake because StarLogo was not nearly complex enough to simulate any real scenario. There were several problems with that course. Of the 8 classes taking the course, only one was taught by a teacher with actual programming experience, which made it exceptionally difficult for the students to get help when they encountered problems with their code. This is a distressingly common situation in schools, perhaps because anyone with programming skills can earn a lot more in almost any other industry than in teaching. There were also a lot of things that StarLogo simply could not do. Any student attempting to program anything complex would run up against the limitations of the system pretty quickly, such as limits on the number of agents that could exist at any given time, complexity of the terrain, etc. There was also a fairly severe lack of documentation and sample code available online, often an issue with programming languages designed for teaching, simply because they lack the large cohort of programmers sharing tips and tricks online that languages used in industry tend to collect. What there was online, however, was a lot of sample bushfire code. Many students dealt with the frustration of trying to do the things the system couldn't do by simply downloading the sample bushfire code and submitting it as their own. Given the lack of support available and the frustration of using that particular system, this isn't terribly surprising, and it wasn't detected at the time. The robotics section of the course used Lego Mindstorms NXT2 robots. While Lego is famous for its easy-to-use, straightforward building instructions, its Mindstorm system is anything but simple. Students had to program the robots to follow lines, push each other out of circles, or find a particular coloured section on a map. The maps were huge and cost a fortune to print. The robots themselves were expensive, and the students hated the course. There were endless problems with loose wires, flat batteries, and broken sensors to overcome. Not to mention the difficulties of learning to program in Mindstorms itself. Some students, who often had Mindstorms robots at home, blitzed these challenges and were bored by the lack of creative choice. Others were frustrated and dispirited by the projects, unable to see the point of wrestling seemingly insurmountable difficulties to achieve something with zero impact. Once again, there was a desperate lack of teachers who could program to help the students. Many students learned that programming was both something they hated and could not do. The natural programming section of the course used slime mold with the aim of showing how slime mold will find the shortest path to food through a maze. Once again, the lack of teachers with experience, in this case experience with slime mold, meant that many of the experiments failed, but there were no teachers qualified to explore why the experiments had failed, so it was another frustrating experience. The final section of the course was Python programming, where students wrote programs to play 21 and tic-tac-toe. Now they were using a real programming language, the third they had been expected to learn that year, StarLogo, Mindstorms, and now Python. But again, they lacked teacher support, with only one teacher who knew Python available to 220 students. Creative Studies was a classic example of the toy approach to teaching computer science. Even though simulation and robotics can be serious, practical topics, in Creative Studies they were taught with toys, StarLogo, and Lego robots. And even though Python is not a toy, the Python programming section focused on games, 21 and tic-tac-toe. There was nothing in this subject to convince these science-minded, intelligent students that programming had anything to offer them. Creative studies was hands down the most hated subject in the school. The students hated it. They could not see any connection between what they were learning or unable to learn in that course and anything they would want to do in the future. And this was a science school where most of the students wanted to go into a science career where they would almost certainly need programming. The teachers also hated it because they felt out of their depth with assignments they could not do themselves and because they were constantly battling the students to try to persuade them to do the work. The real thing. The year after Creative Studies made its unpopular debut, Victor Rajewski and I started teaching our Year 11 computer science subject. We made it an overview of computer science, including artificial intelligence, ethics, algorithms and data structures, computational science, and usability. For the first half of the year, we discussed a lot of complex ideas such as the nature of intelligence and built foundational programming skills in Python. In the second half of the year, while still covering more content in class, the students worked on a computational science assignment where we worked with scientists in order to meet their computational needs. A lot of scientists have little or no background in programming, which significantly limits their research. If you can't use programming as a tool to manage your data, you have to do things like finding duplicates, picking out values that match a particular criteria, and analyzing and visualizing your data by hand. It can take a lot longer and in some cases be a lot less accurate. Because spreadsheet packages such as Excel have a hard limit on the number of rows of data they will load, Excel's current limit is around 1 million, some data sets simply can't be processed at all without programming. Lack of data and computational skills can lead to other issues for scientists too, such as the recent problem in the UK where COVID case numbers went missing because they hit the column limit in Excel, which is just over 16,000 columns, and the data was silently truncated or thrown away. In that first year, we worked with a marine biologist, Dr. Catherine Wheatley, and a molecular biologist, Dr. Michael Gantier. Catherine had a bunch of tracking data about seals, and Michael was doing cancer research and looking for relationships between different types of microRNA. Catherine was hoping to find patterns in the seal data that would make searching through the reams of data easier by identifying sections in the accelerometer data that indicated the seals had caught a fish, for example, and making it possible for her to zero in on that section of the data. Michael needed to compare different RNA samples with results from a range of databases, a task that took weeks to do manually. Both projects were complex and involved working with real data. I made sure that the researchers knew up front that, since this was a student project, there was no guarantee that there would be usable results, and the students knew that their marks for the assignment did not hinge on producing something that actually made a difference to the researchers' work. Instead, their marks were based on documenting the problem, producing a functional, usable, and clearly documented piece of software, and identifying the limitations and errors in their own work. This last step was crucial and became a cornerstone of my approach to projects in the future. I've worked with so many senior, skilled people who struggle with the idea that their own work is not perfect. This renders people unable to improve their work, and it also makes it exceptionally difficult to collaborate. To find the best solutions, we have to be able to improve on the ones that we have. That's impossible to do without recognizing that what we have is not perfect. The capacity to identify flaws in your own work is crucial to developing effective solutions to real problems. The SEAL project turned out to be much, much harder than I had anticipated. Part of a learning experience that continued for several years, it helped me zero in on what kinds of projects worked best, but at the expense of the students who weren't able to achieve high levels of success and actually produce work that supported the researcher. Interestingly, though, the students still seemed to count it as a success. They did well in terms of marks for the assignment, but most of all, they learnt a lot about working with real data, about programming, about working in groups, and of course, about SEALs. It seemed that doing something real, even if it was very difficult and in some cases out of their reach, was far more engaging than playing with toys. I'll talk more later in this chapter about what I learned about the kinds of projects that are most successful. For now, I want to talk about the cancer research with Michael Gantier. One group who tackled this project consisted of two students, Chris and Matt. Both students had significant programming skills coming into the subject. In addition to his strong programming skills, Matt had studied biology and understood what microRNA was and some of what Michael was trying to do. Chris had no biology experience but very strong programming skills. Michael Gantier, meanwhile, had enough computer science background to know what he needed, but not enough programming expertise or time to write the code himself. He was spending weeks on tasks that he knew could be automated, so when he saw my call for projects, which I had sent out through various university academics I knew, he jumped at the chance. For several months, Chris and Matt worked closely with Michael to produce a piece of software that allowed him to search various genetic databases and find matches in a matter of hours rather than days. Michael was thrilled with the software and went on to use it in his research. Chris and Matt could honestly say they had done cancer research in year 11 and knew that they had produced something of value. As a typical software client, Michael then started to fizz with enthusiasm over what else could be done, and this is where something that happened that really emphasized the value of doing real projects. Chris and Matt continued working on the software over the summer break, long after any possibility of receiving course credit had passed. They continued working on it during their year 12 year as well, optimizing the software so that it completed searches in minutes rather than hours and adding in extra features that Michael wanted. I asked Chris in 2020, 9 years after he studied my year 11 subject, what he remembered from that project, and this is what he said. Although I started your unit already with interest and experience in the technical side of programming, the class was my first encounter with the realities of real-world data. In particular, real research data presents challenges in its uncertainty, opacity, and magnitude that cannot be appreciated without hands-on experience. This early exposure equipped me with an understanding of what it means to pull meaning out of data, as well as a readiness for when I would perform analysis on my own results later in my research career. Chris Whittle. You might say that this project was a fluke, that these were two high-performing, extremely motivated students who got excited about a project, and that would certainly be a fair description of Matt and Chris, both of whom are currently working on PhDs. But it kept happening, from molecular biology to neuroscience, from physics to conservation ecology. Every year, at least a few students would get so excited by their projects that they'd keep working on them the next year. Remember my cautionary tale from the introduction, Austin? He was wildly disengaged with the year 10 toy approach to computer science. We couldn't get him to do any work. I was not looking forward to working with him in the year 11 subject. Austin, though, turned into one of the best students I ever had. He partnered with another student, Michael, for the computational science assignment, and together they produced some of the most extraordinary work I have ever seen. The project that year sprang from a talk I went to at the Nepean Conservation Society. The speaker that day was Judith Muir, owner of Polpero Dolphin Swims, a dolphin touring company in Port Phillip Bay that is dedicated to the protection of the local dolphin population and the overall health of the marine environment. Judith talked about the data they've collected about the dolphins over the years and how that data gets sent to government regulators where, as far as she can tell, it sits on a shelf somewhere. Of course, the combination of data and dolphins was irresistible to me, so I waylaid Judy after her talk and we quickly became collaborators and co-conspirators. Judith gave me access to the data, which was handwritten notes from each tour over a period of about 8 years. I found volunteers to transcribe it with all of the usual challenges of handwriting, format, and interpretation that handwritten data brings with it. I had students produce heat maps of where the dolphins were typically found, among many other different ways of wrangling the data. But Austin and Michael took a different approach. They decided this handwritten data thing was a nonsense they could do without, so they decided to create an app that the Polpero crew could use to record the data, automating the entry of common phrases and including GPS coordinates, rather than the location estimates that they had been using, which included east of Point King and just off White Cliffs. They produced a problem specification document that was one of the most professional I've seen in schools or in industry. The problem specification is the part most programming nerds loathe because they see it as tedious paperwork, and it was rarely a highlight of these assignments. As well as the app, they produced a server-side program that would run on the Polpero's office computer to produce the forms required by government regulators from the information collected by the app. The whole project had a focus on reliability and usability that is rarely seen in student projects, though it was a focus of the marking scheme. Austin and Michael continued working on the project over the summer and into the next year. Remember, Austin didn't do a stitch of work with the toys, but together with Michael, he produced an outstanding project as soon as I gave him something real to do. That project was amazing, not merely because I got a few extra trips on Polpero as a result. The Polpero crew are the most passionate, knowledgeable, and skillful team, and a trip on Polpero is an extraordinary delight. but also because it confirmed for me the motivational power of doing something meaningful. In the year before I left teaching, 2017, one of the projects was another genetics-based data project with Dr. Sonika Tyagi from Monash. This time there was a machine learning aspect to the work. There were three projects that year, and the scientists involved came and pitched the projects to the students, who then chose the one they found most interesting or most challenging. I was rather startled to be approached by a Year 11 student not studying computer science by the name of Victor, who pleaded with me to be allowed to work on the genetics project. He laid out his credentials in biology and programming in great detail, assured me that he was excellent at working in groups, and promised me that he would be able to make seriously useful contributions to the project. How could I say no? That project produced such strong results that the students involved presented their work at the Lawn Genome Conference at the start of 2018. When students consistently kept working on the projects after the assignment was over, when students who weren't even doing the subject asked to do the assignment, that told me this was something special. It really confirmed to me that data projects needed to spread, that while I was having a significant impact on my own students, every Australian student needed access to projects this engaging, this motivating, and this real. Getting real. With projects this successful and motivating in Year 11, I was increasingly convinced we were on the wrong track with our Year 10 subject. From 2010, the year before I started there, until 2016, we continued with variations on the same theme. We used different programming environments, but always block-based, and tweaked the projects, but the problems were always the same, and the feedback from the students was terrible. The head of faculty who was in charge of the subject was convinced that the subject worked, though, and was reluctant to change it. One of the things that startled me about working in a school was that there was no culture of evaluating courses or teaching. It was common to write a new course, run it, and never ask the students for feedback on the course, nor systematically track their results. It was one of the things that frustrated me when I was trying to show that the course we were teaching was not working, because it was very difficult to get permission to run feedback surveys. Eventually, the faculty head did run a feedback survey, but it was not anonymous. Of the 200 students taking the subject that year, we had 20 respondents, all aware their identities were known, and all saying anodyne, safe things about the subject. The questions on that survey were leading, too. It is well understood in research that asking students to agree with the statement the subject was fun and engaging will get a very different response to how did you feel about the subject. How you ask the questions on your survey makes a significant difference to your results. Because we were now in a pitched battle about how the subject should look the next year, I eventually managed to persuade the school to run some focus groups about the subject, led by a teacher from a different faculty. Now the students were able to give feedback to a teacher who was not connected to the subject, and wow, were they honest. The feedback was direct and to the point. The fundamental message which underpins all of the issues with the toy approach to teaching technology was that students could not see the point of what they were supposed to be learning. And kids can be quite pragmatic. When they can't see any point to what they're doing, they don't do it. We had highly capable students failing the subject entirely because they refused to do the work. The official response to this was sometimes to force the student to repeat the subject, with predictable results. We had other students cheating, copying each other's work, copying work off the internet, or simply paying someone else to do the work. And we had many, many students who tried because they wanted the marks, but wound up demoralized and miserable, convinced that they hated computing and that computing hated them. All we were succeeded in doing was proving to the students that computing was a nightmare, and in most cases, something they were not equipped to understand, the exact opposite of what we needed to do. After that crisis point, there was still a lot of back and forth about how the subject should look, but eventually I got permission to trial a small project. I had one student who was absolutely enthralled with politics and the strange way preferences flow in the Senate for the Australian federal election. So since we had recently had an election, I trawled the Australian Electoral Commission website to look for data we could use. I hit the jackpot in the form of a comma-separated values, CSV, file that contained every single Victorian vote for the Senate in the federal election. It was quite a treasure trove, but like all real data sets, it was quite messy. For a student project, though, that was perfect. Every row of the file represented a single ballot paper. It contained the electorate, the polling booth, and the contents of every box on the ballot paper. The first field was the name of the electorate, the second was the polling place, the next three numbers were some kind of internal data we didn't bother with, and the final string of numbers and commas was an encoding of the actual ballot paper, where each comma denoted a new square. The ballot paper went on for 40 columns, with a total of 151 squares on the full paper. The first step in dealing with this data set was to figure out how the one-dimensional string of numbers and commas representing a vote mapped onto the two-dimensional ballot paper. This was further complicated by the fact that the columns on the ballot paper could contain anything from 2 to 12 entries. I called the AEC, who were unable to find me anyone who could explain the mapping. Presumably they have such people, but the people on the switchboard either could not or would not find them for me. So I spent some time writing Python programs to figure out which people got the most votes and finally deduced the mapping using the reported results and the results of my Python scripts. To understand the true magic of this project, we need to know a little about Senate voting in Australian federal elections. In the 2016 election, the rules had changed. People could put at least six numbers above the line, starting from one, voting for whole parties, or they could put a minimum of 12 numbers below the line, again starting from one. Each number is only allowed to be used once, so you can only vote one for a single party or a single person. You can't vote above and below the line. You must choose one or the other. If that's as clear as mud, these are the AEC's own words. On the white Senate ballot paper, you need to either number at least six boxes above the line for the parties or groups of your choice, or number at least 12 boxes below the line for individual candidates of your choice. In dealing with the ballot paper, the students naturally assumed that when they processed the strings representing each vote, over 3 million of them, they would only find each number once, that people would either have voted above the line or below the line but not both, and generally that voters would have followed the rules. Of course, people are not very good at following the rules, plus the rules had just changed, and the file was a faithful representation of exactly what was written on every ballot paper, meaning that some lines contained the number one several times, some voted above and below the line at the same time, and some just did wild things that made no sense according to the rules. It was the perfect introduction to data science as an authentic study. No real data set is entirely predictable and perfect. You have to assume that your data set will contain the unexpected. We spent some time as a class discussing what types of questions the data could answer, and then the students got to devise their own questions to explore. The questions included how many people voted against the rules and hence did not have their vote counted, which party's voters were more likely to follow their party's how-to-vote card, how did the voters in my electorate vote, how did the voters at my polling booth vote, and was that different to my electorate as a whole? If people voted one for party A, who did they vote two for? Where did the people who voted for party B come from, e.g. city, suburban, or rural? What percentage of votes did women candidates receive compared with the percentage of candidates who were women? I taught the students just enough Python to extract the answers to their questions, and then they created engaging visualizations to answer them the questions. These were not simple graphs, though the scale needed to be accurate, but creative images that were more engaging and compelling than a graph could be. Once again, a student took the project and ran with it, extending it into a preference flow prediction tool that he was still working on at university some years later. That was exciting, but what really impressed me was the turnaround in feedback for the subject overall. By this time, I was running anonymous feedback surveys at the end of every unit, and now the vast majority of students were saying that they could see the point of the work, that they were using the skills learned in that unit elsewhere, and that the subject was absolutely relevant to them and their futures. Sadly, I was not able to bring work samples or survey results with me when I left the school, but the impact of that shift was so dramatic that it has stayed with me, a constant motivation for my work at the Australian Data Science Education Institute. The next year, we used data collected by local volunteers about microbats in Melbourne with one group and climate change data with another, and both projects again saw high levels of engagement and motivation from the students. With the microbats, we did a small sample project initially where all of the students analysed the data for an answer to the same question: which bat box or nesting box orientation did the bats prefer in the different seasons? This was an incredibly simple set of data with a very easy question to answer, and I expected the visualizations to be 48 variations on the same theme, most likely something involving a compass with different sized bats on it. I was astounded when the assignments were submitted. The range of creativity and innovation that the students used in representing this simple data set was phenomenal. That was a pivotal moment to me. The data did not need to be complex or challenging in order to engage the students. It just had to be real and meaningful. Though the bat box orientation data was simple, just a count of how many bats had been found in each box in each season and the orientation of the boxes, the full data set for the microbats was quite messy, as the volunteers had put multiple sets of information in single sheets, changed the labels they used for some values, and occasionally changed the way they recorded their data. Again, a messy and authentic data set was just what students needed to learn real data science skills, as opposed to how to answer textbook questions on a perfect data set and how to pass exams. The climate change data set we worked with was even simpler. It was a set of temperature predictions based on a range of different climate models, predicting average global temperatures from 2015 to 2090. All the students had to do was extract the data from their chosen model from the file, graph it, and create a final visualization to make the data compelling. Some students did far more than that, seeking out historical temperature data from other sources so that they could create a visualization showing the changes over a much greater timescale, a much more compelling image. Some worked with predicted sea level rises, creating visualizations that showed playgrounds underwater or a child's bed afloat, or the barrels of salt that would represent increasing salinity of warmer oceans. Some just did the basics of the assignment, but then went on to use the skills they had used in their science projects and elsewhere. They marveled repeatedly at how useful and meaningful these skills were. As always, some of the students needed a lot of help to find their question and decide on a compelling visualization. The subject had a lot of problems too. We still did not have anywhere near enough skilled teachers to teach every class, and one of our skilled teachers became ill, leaving us even more short-staffed. The students were not supported enough when writing their code and analyzing their data. Yet, despite that, the final feedback survey showed that the vast majority of students had a sense of achievement and felt that the subject was deeply relevant to them and their futures. It's important to note that what we were teaching was not what a professional data scientist would recognize as data science. It was really basic data literacy, very simple data analysis, and visualization as communication more than as a complex technical skill. But these are the essential foundations of the discipline, which are often glossed over in the rush to technical skills. If a data scientist does not understand the context, the limitations, and the flaws of the data they are working with, and does not know how to communicate their results effectively to others, then all the complex technical skills in the world will not make them effective at their job. If all the students took from the subject was the ability to critically analyze graphs, to look for the limitations and flaws of a data set, and to challenge and critically evaluate their own work, they'd still have been far better equipped to understand the COVID-19 pandemic, as well as to challenge the ideological rhetoric that too often takes the place of evidence-based policymaking in both business and governments. I've described some of the projects I taught, but how would you go about creating your own project along these lines? In my work with ADSI, I have devised templates to make the creation of these projects easier, and I'm building a curated set of datasets to take the work out of finding and making sense of real-world datasets. In Chapter 7, we'll look at the templates and some more examples of projects that you can do across all year levels, right across the curriculum. Thanks for listening to the Raising Heretics podcast. If you like it, share it, talk about it, review it, and make some noise. Let's get on with changing the world. See you next time.